So I think this is, excuse me, actually the final talk of the program, as far as I understand it. And I guess it's appropriate to thank the organizers for a stimulating program.
This is the last chance for a speaker to do exotic dancing.
there's that. And I actually find right. Thank you, Antoine. I actually find the program to be remarkably successful. One thing being that the organizers actually managed to succeed where the Fox News failed, which is to copyright a common word like exotic. So anyway, my talk is Exotic Quantum Criticality in Condor Lattices, and I'm not entirely sure whether the word exotic here is being used in the copyrighted sense, but in any case, what I'll start is to actually show two pieces of experiments which I found quite striking. One having to do with the Fermi surface evolution across a magnetic quantum critical heavy fermion system, and another has to do with the unusual dynamics in the vicinity of the quantum critical point. And actually, in the end, I decided that it would be too much to just purely sketch these data, so therefore the PowerPoint. And then I'll move on to the some microscopic work, which at least lead us to believe that these very unusual quantum critical behavior is possible once one takes into account effects that I'll describe in some detail, the destruction of the Kondo effect. And then I'll describe some issues, concrete issues one may be able to address going beyond the microscopics. So, let me actually acknowledge my collaborators, Li-Jun Zhu, Stefan Kirshner, Eugene Pivovalov, and Kevin Ingerson, Daniel Grandpao, and Jerry Shin Zhu. And I also have had recent collaborations with Frank Stagish Group and Piers Coleman on some of the experimental signatures. Now, we've had a lot of discussions about magnetic systems in this program. And one way to look at a Kondo lattice is to start from your favorite magnetic system. And in these, in the heavy fermions at least, typically it's not Heisenberg. There's a symmetry breaking in spin space of various kind, and I'll describe some of these in the two materials I'll mention. And then you couple these spins to a band of fermions through this Kondo coupling. And in this particular context, we are interested in spin 1/2, and the Kondo coupling will be antiferromagnetic. And a model like this is supposed to describe pretty reasonably at least the heavy fermions which are close to a magnetic quantum phase transition. So the two systems which have been most extensively studied in this particular context are ytterbium rhodium 2 silicon 2 and cerium copper 6 slightly doped with gold. And one of the particularly helpful features from some perspective is that both of these systems, before you actually dope it or apply pressure or apply magnetic field, are already very close to a quantum critical point. So for instance, in ytterbium rhodium 2 silicon 2, at ambient pressure, without any doping, the nail temperature is only 70 millikelvin. Okay? And a very small magnetic field, for instance, if you apply a magnetic field of 60 millitesla in the AB plane, or 0.7 tesla along the C direction, you're already sitting at the quantum critical point. So that magnetic field tuning, presumably there's no issue of disorder, but even in systems like with gold doping, when the doping concentration is small, presumably disorder effect is not as important. There are a zoo of other heavy fermions in which disorder is clearly a zeroth order effect. Now, let me just run down the particular features which perhaps are good to keep in mind. Ytterbium rhodium 2 silicon 2 is tetragonal. And the spin space has easy plane anisotropy. So for instance, if you measure the magnetic response in the AB plane versus along the C direction, at low temperatures, this ratio is about 100 to 1. So it's very strongly XY. And the scale that's good to keep in mind is that at a single ion Condor scale, which you can determine from entropy and other measurements, is about 20 Kelvin. So for this material, anything above 20 Kelvin is high temperature behavior. And you may expect scaling or quantum critical behaviors at 20 Kelvin and below.
The entropy is defined as the temperature at which the entropy becomes bigger than.
There's log 2 is where, yeah, that's right. And the heavy fermion community has various other ways, like thermal power should show a gigantic feature around single ion Condor scale, which they do, and they measure lots of crystal field splitting, et cetera. So this is a rough scale, which actually is manifested in a low temperature measurements as well. Cerium copper 6 gold. Would it become magnetic. It starts from paramagnetic, so that's unlike that one. It would be rhodium to silicon too. But if you introduce small amount of doping, it turns into anti-ferromagnetic, and the critical concentration is where gold is 1 by, about 2% of doping. And the structure is nearly orthorhombic. There's a very small distortion. And in spin space, there's easy axis anisotropy. If you measure the C versus A versus B response in the magnetic response, there's not a very strong temperature dependence here compared to the ytterbium rhodium to silicon 2 case. And ratio is somewhat smaller, but it's still 10 to 2 to 1. Okay, so it's here the cutoff scale is slightly smaller, and 6 Kelvin and above, that's high energy behavior. And these structures are not obviously frustrated, at least geometrically. And there are actually some heavy fermions where there's geometrical frustration, but that's just coming out. The phases that we are dealing with are pretty innocent. There's the antiferromagnetic metal on the one side and the paramagnetic metal. The paramagnetic metal looks very much like the canonical heavy fermion metals with fermi liquid behavior. And to a stronger extent in ytterbium rhodium to silicon 2 than in cerium copper 6 gold, we're also sure that the antiferromagnetic metal itself is a fermi liquid. So I think it's important to keep in mind that the phases that we are dealing with are pretty conventional. While the quantum critical behavior we'll see is pretty strange. So let me illustrate the strangeness by two pieces of experiment. This is a completely reversed historical order. And the whole measurement is just coming out. It's actually only in existence in preprint form. Let me just first sketch and then tell you where the sketch came from. This is ytterbium rhodium 2 silicon 2. You start from nail state and apply around this control parameter. This is actually a magnetic field. It runs through the quantum critical point. And by various analysis, which I'll describe in the next transparency, one finds that the whole number has a sharp jump at the quantum critical point in a zero temperature limit. And this is, of course, by extrapolation. And the jump is actually a pretty significant number. And so this would suggest that there's a sudden collapse and reconstruction of the Fermi surface at the quantum critical point. And that goes beyond any of the conventional quantum critical behavior that we would associate with magnetic systems. Many of you would know that there's this picture of Hertz, Millis, Maria, in which the critical behavior for in an internal electron system is supposed to be such that due to Landau damping, you're actually in above upper critical dimension, and the critical modes are the paramagnons, and in that case, you would have Fermi surface, which would be once you go into the older side, it will be folding due to the reduced magnetic Brillouin zone. But that process can be considered to be gradual in a sense that the Hall coefficient would have to be at least continuous. There could be a kink, and a degree of non-analyticity depends on how the order parameter evolves with the distance from quantum critical point. But a jump is a drastic departure, and that suggests that Fermi surface is doing much more than this Hertz, Millis, Maria picture would suggest.
And we know that it's not a first-order transition.
We know it's not a first-order phase transition because you can follow a Néel temperature curve. And there are two things which have been done. One is that you follow a Néel temperature curve, and it goes down essentially smooth as best as experimentalists can tell. Second is that the starting point, which is the ytterbium rhodium to silicon tool at without any applying anything, the magnetic order parameter is already tiny. Its staggered moment is about 0.00 something. And so even if it were strictly a first order phase transition, it's going to be a very weak first order phase transition.
Actually, I had a question directly on these experiments that connect to this one. This is a zero temperature extrapolation of these curves you showed me, right?
Right.
Gradually decreasing temperature.
Yeah.
If one makes these measurements by sweeping the field up and then sweeping it down, is there any kind of hysteresis?
There's no indication of hysteresis as far as I know, yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
These are XY and isotropic as far as the moment scale, but these are electronically two-dimensional systems, right?
Well, it's a tetragonal. And transport show some anisotropy of, I forgot the exam number, but 5 to 1 or 3 to 1. But the magnetic component actually, for this compound, there's actually no magnetic measurement. The crystals are too small and so on and so forth. Néel temperature too small for the purpose of magnetic measurement. But in the related compound, cerium, palladium to silicon to, we know that there's some kind of frustration if you go along the c-axis because you have like a square lattice. And if it's anti-ferromagnetic, then the next layer one is actually in the middle of the square lattice. So it's feasible that the magnetic spectrum is very anisotropic, but we don't know.
But I thought in your first transparency you said it was didn't you say it was an XY?
That's the spin.
That's a spin space.
No, but you're asking about the spatial.
Well, okay. No, so you answered the third question. I only asked it. So as far as the single site goes, it's XY. As far as the electronics go, it's 5 times more conducting in the planes than, let's say, perpendicular.
A number of order, yeah.
The magnetic exchanges themselves could be frustrated.
Could be frustrated along the C direction, yes. And this compound, we actually have the inelastic magnetic spectrum I'll show, and it's quite two-dimensional spatially. So let me actually, because this is actually a pretty drastic conclusion. Yeah.
This was done with pressure or field?
With magnetic field. Yeah. And so this extrapolation was done as follows. You do a measurement of the Hall coefficient at a constant temperature as a function of magnetic field. And then you see at any finite temperature, there's no jump. There's always a crossover. What is striking is that you see a very sharp crossover. But the width is always finite. So you can plot two things. One is where, for instance, the inflection point is at a given temperature. And you do another measurement at a different temperature. And this line that follows. And the other is the width as a function of temperature, and you find that the crossover width is becoming smaller as temperature is lowered. Which, and you know, the range is not that big, but if you actually try to fit it with a power law, you can. Okay, so that would imply that the extrapolated zero temperature limit is that the width is going to zero. Okay.
What's the difference between the green and red
dots? The green, so that's getting the intricacies of the measurement. This is a field-driven transition. And you have to ask, what do you mean by Hall coefficient?
What do you mean?
Okay. And thank you. And the green ones are actually an experiment which is done with two magnet field. One field is in the current direction. So you're actually tuning a state without causing the Lorentz force through the zeroth order. And then you have a second field which allows you to do linear response measurement. And these are obviously much harder measurements, so therefore they're only 4 points. The red one is just look at the single field measurement and look differential Hall coefficient.
Differential.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the important point is that the two are actually on top of each other, more or less. Yeah.
What's the direction of magnetic for a red curve?
For a red curve, is along C direction.
C direction.
Yeah.
And yeah, T star is the temperature below which you find T square again. Or
precisely. Yeah.
The resistivity.
Yeah. So the nail. So this answers part of your question. T nail looks. I mean, this is actually the points, discrete points, I suppose. So the important point is that this width is extrapolating to zero, and this line is actually extrapolating to a quantum critical point. So if there's a jump, the jump could, in principle, happen anywhere along the line of a control parameter space. But the important point here is that jumping point coincides with the magnetic quantum transition point. Now, the second piece of experiment is actually historically the one which motivated largely this line of work, which was the measurement of inelastic neutron scattering and other magnetic measurements. And they were very striking in the following sense. First of all, the frequency and the temperature dependencies of the dynamical spin susceptibility shows an exponent which is less than 1. And that's in deviation, again, from the Hertz picture. And secondly, it obeys omega over T scaling to the extent that one can, to the best analysis one can do. And so both features are incompatible with this Gaussian picture and implying that the fixed point is an interacting one. And there's even more striking feature than that, which is that this enormous exponent is apparently seen, quote unquote, everywhere in a momentum space. So it's not just in the vicinity of the anti-Fellow-Mann wave vector that you're seeing this fractional exponent. And so let me just show you the data which led to those statements. So E over T scaling is plotted here. This is the inelastic neutron scattering at the anti-Fellow-Mann wave vector. And it's a log-log scale, so you may question, but if you take the data on a linear scale, the fractional exponent is visibly better than the integer exponent, but that's the best we can do. So if you make a plot like that would be happy to live on a log-log plane, you get an exponent that's 0.75. And the important point is that if you do Cramer's chronic, you can look at the static susceptibility, and this is the inverse of that susceptibility at the same wave vector at the anti-Fellow magnetic wave vector, and plot that as a function of temperature, it is compatible with this same exponent, 0.75. And moreover, if you measure the uniform spin susceptibility, plot H over M, of course it's finite at zero temperature limits, but the temperature dependence follows the same exponent. And in between neutron data with less of accuracy, but you still do Cramer's chronic. So this is the plot which leads to the statement that the same fractional exponent apparently is being seen in a broad region of the Brillouin zone.
What temperature range is this?
Yeah, so it's just, this is what? This is 5 to the power of 4/3, I guess.
How low?
It goes all the way to about 50 millikelvin or so. So it's about 2 decades of temperature, roughly 2 decades of frequency on the left. Okay.
And unfortunately, there are no neutrons on the other guy, right?
Unfortunately, yeah. Yeah. So if we take the point of view, I mean, both pieces of data really, I think the whole data is probably more direct, but the neutron data clearly is also telling us that this mean field picture, the deeper Z larger than 4 picture, is not working. Incidentally, if you just are concerned with fractional exponent, there's work by people like Andrew Chubukov who can, within the Hertz picture, can get within commensurate magnetic ordering, et cetera, can get exponents which are fractional. But omega over t scaling will not come out from that that picture. So as far as we know, it's hard to just tweak with the parallel magnon picture to understand these dynamics, and certainly not the jump of the Hall coefficient. So what I'll go on from here is first describe some result of the microscopic work, and then come back and ask some questions beyond the microscopics. And the reason is that the Kondo effect, even for the heavy fermion state, this is considered to be an understood problem, that if you have a bunch of local moments interacting with a band of fermions in an anti-ferromagnetic fashion, spin one half single channel, you're supposed to have a heavy fermi liquid with large fermi surface. This is considered to be an understood problem. But if you actually want to incorporate that in any of theoretical treatment, there's not actually that many ways of describing it. And perhaps and the only way, microscopically, the only approaches which have been used, which actually describe the large Fermi surface, is slave Boson mean field theory and the dynamical mean field theory. The static mean field theory is not adequate to describe critical behavior. So what we've been pursuing is really some extended version of dynamical mean field theory, with the hope that at least we can get a caricature of all these possibilities of different kinds of phase transitions. And I'll describe the technique just briefly in a short while. But the result is that if I look at this axis, there are indeed two kinds of transitions which can happen. So this is a Kondo axis, increase the Kondo interaction of the fermions with the moments. And G is sort of a hypothetical axis in some sense. But in the particular treatment, this region actually, the strictly 3D limit is here for the magnetism. And this red region actually arises when the magnetic fluctuations are two-dimensional. And what is happening here is that this green curve describes a transition from a paramagnetic metal with Kondo screening, and therefore large Fermi surface, into a paramagnetic metal where the Fermi surface has not really changed except for the folding due to the breaking of translation invariance. Well, across any point on this red line, one directly goes from a paramagnetic metal phase with Kondo screening to a near order state without Kondo screening. And I'll make these statements more precise as we go on. And if a material is such that it's taking a cut like this, the critical behavior would go back to the parallel magnon picture, presumably, barring some non-annihilated states of the coefficients of the parallel magnon of the 5-4 theory due to the fermions. If you take a cut across across this red line, on the other hand, we have the quantum critical behavior that's reflecting not only the onset of magnetism, but also the destruction of Kondo screening. And that's where there are interesting possibilities that can arise. So,
just an uninformed question. Is there any sense in which the, you know, the fermented behavior of the nail state is light, not heavy?
That's actually a very important question. So within the picture of just going directly into a state without Kondo screening, with nail, in a nail order state without Kondo screening, ultimately the mass will be light. But on the other hand, if you're in the immediate vicinity of critical behavior, then fluctuations and so on and so forth make it hard to actually tell whether it's small mass or not.
Experimentally,
if the ytterbium rhodium to silicon two, if you are staying in the vicinity of the quantum critical point, the mass remains pretty high inside order state. Now it becomes smaller and smaller.
Mass
here means operational definition for that is gamma in the zero temperature limit. But if you go to deeper and deeper, which you can do in this compound by applying pressure, it does become smaller. And then one can argue whether that's, in the end, whether it's small enough for the picture to be valid. And that we don't really know yet. This is the mysterious G axis. In the microscopics, this is the anisotropy you can put in the microscopic calculations from purely cubic to the 2D magnetism, spatial anisotropy.
Leon was signing a joke, which I didn't get.
I didn't hear it.
G is what?
G is the spatial anisotropy going from purely
spatial
cubic of the magnetic fluctuation spectrum.
So this is of the exchanges.
Of the exchanges, exactly.
Okay, so this is the three-dimensional axis. That's the quantum axis.
So G, I mean, what I really have in mind is
G equals zero corresponds to
the pure, exactly. And on this red line is when the magnetism is two-dimensional.
It's true.
On the red line or G big?
No, on this red line. So within this microscopic approach, one can get a direct transition only in a purely 2D magnetic fluctuation spectrum.
So I still don't understand what G means. What does G bigger than that mean?
Yeah.
Well, it's a heuristic plot. What I'm conjecturing is that if microscopic result is capturing is that if you have increased quantum fluctuations of some kind, certain reduced dimensionality does that. Other ways of doing that is certainly is possible, J2 over J1 and so on and so forth, that you are actually moving along on this axis. So perhaps even in purely 3D systems, if you increase enough of the frustration and...
Can I think of it this way? If I take your red curve, turn it up and take it off to infinity, and think of this as the anisotropy, then you want an RG flow in that portion that goes that way.
Well, secretly in my mind is that eventually this line will hit with some point here, which would be a purely disorderly transition of the magnet.
But I thought you were talking about the anisotropy of the magnet. These are two different things. Right? I could disorder the magnet by keeping it cubic,
right,
or I could disorder the magnet by driving it two-dimensional.
Right.
It's the latter
that has been done.
Okay. And you want to somehow think of the red portion as representing a two-dimensional universality class, as it were.
That's a result of the calculation, yes.
That is it.
Yeah. Okay. Is everybody else happy with this line?
So you model the conduction electrons or the conduction band as two-dimensional or three-dimensional as it go up in
the conduction electrons is three-dimensional.
Always.
Yeah.
You're not changing that dimension.
It doesn't really matter that much.
Well, we're really doing some local approximation.
Right, yeah. Okay. But the magnetism does. So if I take a cut across the red line, basically, as I said, there are two things happening at the same time at the quantum critical point. One is the onset of magnetism, and the other is this what's described by this scale E star, And E star basically is like a coherence scale. So if I'm deep on the paramagnetic side, E star is like a lattice condo temperature below which we have well-developed condo resonances and large Fermi surface, et cetera, et cetera. But at a critical point, the destruction of the condo screening going into anti-fellow magnet without condo screening is characterized by the vanishing of this E star scale. And within this microscopic approach, these two things can coincide when the local spin susceptibility is also divergent at the quantum critical point. And microscopically, it's divergent in a logarithmic fashion, okay? And where delta is essentially bare condo scale. And once we have this additional piece of physics of the destruction of the condo screening, then the damping does not have to be linear in omega, as it would be when one considered damping to be due to particle holes and quasi-particles were still well defined at the quantum critical point, like in the Hertz picture. And this actually would create some epsilon expansion, but I'll show some numerics on what the fractional the alpha comes out to be. Okay.
What's rho I?
So for that, this is like some RKQY density states essentially characterizes, it's the inverse of this is essentially exchange interaction. So you can think of rho I as just inverse of the exchange interaction.
So, is this supposed to be a universal number, or does it depend on?
Within this microscopic approach, this result doesn't have to be universal, but if you do a numerical calculation, you vary the initial parameters of the Hamiltonian, get to the quantum critical point, different quantum point with different combination of parameters, alpha came to be essentially the same. So, I mean, the reason is that the critical point is where these two scales are roughly of the same order of magnitude.
So lambda really is a cutoff scale.
Yeah.
So in principle, this alpha would be very small.
No, but this at the critical point is where the exchange interaction is roughly the same order of magnitude as. Numerically, it came out to be for the Eisen case, we find evidence for being close to 0.7.
So where did you put the information there's been fluctuations at
2 hours? So for that, I'll show you in the next transparency.
You claim the local susceptibility diverges, so that comes sort of.
That comes out of calculation. In other words, within this this microscopic calculation, the two, the place where the magnetic transition takes place, which is the peak susceptibility divergent, would coincide with where there's a destruction of condo screening, which in this approach is characterized by divergence of local susceptibility. The two things can happen at the same point only when both the local susceptibility and the peak susceptibility are divergent. And that comes out of calculation when you're in 2D.
So the assumption is that there is some kind of marginal operator that remains. I mean, this looks like similar purity physics, even though it's an extended system.
Right.
So why don't these impurities talk to each other and become,
well, there's some degree of interaction which are already incorporated in this approach, which is this exchange interaction. I'll describe in next transparency that's incorporated at the impurity level, some fluctuating magnetic field. So that's the physics which only exists in a lattice problem when the spins start talking to each other. It didn't exist in a local moment. Now, in a single impurity problem. The real question, however, that's clearly only part of the inter-spin interaction process. So the basic assumption in this approach is that the spin self-energy is strongly omega-dependent, but weakly Q-dependent. So spin self-energy, this is a quantity, ex- expression I can always define, where I of Q is the Fourier transform of exchange interaction.
Is there an assumption
so let me just... there's not that assumption. The assumption that comes in is that the spatial, in other words, the any momentum dependence coming from the spins talking to each other is not more singular than Q minus capital Q square in the vicinity. So in other words, the anomalous dimension for the spatial fluctuations is equal to zero, while the anomalous dimension in the temporal fluctuations can be non-zero. And what it captures, for instance, for the anti-ferromagnetic case, if you want to capture this transition from the paramagnetic phase to the nail phase without this destruction of Kondo screening, where it would be the damping would be just a linear in ohmic lambda damping.
This would sense, yeah. I mean, this is kind of improve that. I mean, that sounds rather remarkable that an extended system would do that. You would not see a crossover.
The scheme itself will not allow you to prove that.
I mean,
you cannot generalize. But
the
argument is as follows: if I consider long wavelength fluctuations, in the end, if the long wavelength fluctuations and the nonlinear couplings are still irrelevant, then you will not generate ADA once you get into this quantum critical point. So there's an internal consistency one can check. So here, if the exponent alpha comes out to be fractional, the effective z would be 2 over alpha that's larger than 2, and d plus z would be still larger than 4. So for the long wavelength spatial fluctuations, eta equals 0 at least would be internally consistent.
In the experiments you have that you had funny frequency and temperature dependence at all points in the zone.
Yeah.
Here, is that true, or is it only at...
It is true, and because if my spin self energy has anomalous exponent for every Q, so then if you build into here, now of course there's divergence at anti-ferromagnetic wave vector, and there's no divergence elsewhere, but the frequency and temperature dependence would be having this anomalous exponent everywhere in Q. The real question is, does experiment actually tell you that the spatial eta is indeed zero or not? And that, there's no enough of the accuracy.
The statement you previously made about alpha was just that although the formula written involves a cutoff, and you actually, there's also an implicit cutoff dependent where you find the transition.
Right, precisely, yeah. Right. So let me just briefly mention, I think I've already described that, which is that within this extended DMFT scheme, what one does is to consider the lattice Kondo problem as an effective Kondo model with the self-consistency conditions. And what the interactions between local moments are doing is reflected here through a fluctuating magnetic field path that the local moment sees, and with the dispersion that's going to be self-consistently determined. And also, in the usual dynamical mean field sense, there's also the fermion bath, which whose dispersion will be self-consistently determined. And the basic assumption here is that one can consider this electron self-energy and spin self-energy to be momentum independent. With that assumption, then we know how to calculate the lattice quantities, for instance, the dynamical spin susceptibility. And there's a self-consistency condition which you can essentially write as the local susceptibility being Q average of this lattice susceptibility. And it's where the Q average, which will depend on what's the dispersion of the exchange interactions, where this procedure knows the dimensionality of the underlying magnetic fluctuation spectrum. Okay. And so for the rest of the talk, for the picture, it's good just to have this in mind of describing the lattice system in terms of local moment in a self-consistently determined fermion bath and the fluctuating magnetic field bath. Now, the reason that that we can get into the region where there's a destruction of the Kondo screening is that if you look at this effective Bose-Fermi Kondo model, and imagine that the dispersion of this fluctuating magnetic field is such that the corresponding dissipation spectrum is omega to gamma, with gamma less than 1, the gamma is going to be self-consistently determined, then this Bose-Fermi Kondo problem knows that one can get into a critical manifold on which the Kondo screening is destroyed. So this G is the coupling to this fluctuating magnetic field. The Kondo, J Kondo, is the initial bare anti-Fellow magnetic Kondo coupling. And if one of them is more dominant, you get to the Kondo screened phase. And if the other dominates, you get into a point where this the Kondo coupling is completely decoupled. And the critical manifold with a critical point is where you hit the point where the Kondo scale has just gone down to zero. So self-consistently, if in the end the solution is such that effective we are effectively sitting here, then at a quantum critical point, then that means that the Kondo screening is still taking place at the magnetic quantum critical point. And that's where we end up on this blue line, where the transition is between the parallel magnetic phase and the nail phase without with the fermions essentially not doing much. While if you solve the lattice problem and find that one is sitting on this critical manifold, that means that Kondo screening is destroyed, and one would be going from at a critical point is of the lattice transition, when the effective imperial problem is sitting here, and there's this additional physics of the destruction of the Kondo screening at a quantum critical point. And so one can go combine this kind of phase diagram with the self-consistency conditions and get these two types of transitions in the Kondo lattice system.
What's the effect of spin anisotropy?
The effect of spin anisotropy, spin anisotropy is not relevant here. Spin anisotropy is relevant for both of these two fixed points. So that can lead to different exponents and so on and so forth. But you can still get the type of transition where the destruction of Kondo screening coincides with magnetic transition in all the different anisotropic cases.
So along the JK equals 0 axis, what's the behavior at that fixed point?
Yeah, so that depends very strongly on the spin anisotropy or not. So in the SU2 case, this is a place where this is actually the initial work in some large N formulation was due to Sachdev and Ye, where you have the spin correlators which decays like one of a tau to some exponent, and the exponent depends on that gamma.
So it's not an ordered state.
It's a local version of some kind of spin liquid behavior. On the other hand, if you are in an icing case, then it's really a decoupled moment, which is the behavior of that fixed point.
Or decoupled both from the conduction electrons and from each other.
The more precise statement is that the spin correlator has a disconnected piece, a finite piece. In the icing case.
Are these JK and G independent parameters?
No, they are.
Using a model, they are probably related.
So there are two levels. If I take the model that I started, G would be dependent on the RKKY couplings. So where, if you go along this axis, where you are will be dependent on how big the Kondo coupling is, for instance. J Kondo, you can just keep it fixed and take the modifications in the dispersions of the fermion bath.
So, at least in the isotropic case, it's simpler to think about maybe your transition is from a Kondo screened phase to a spin liquid phase?
Yes, I think SU2 case, you can think that way. Yeah. In the icing case,
so
one cannot.
It doesn't shift your magnetic field.
For the local problem, yeah.
Maybe I can make just a comment that helps clarify the discussion, okay? We've shifted from the previous slide to this slide, okay? Mm-hmm. From a lattice problem to an impurity problem.
Right.
This is a very well-defined problem. We have a condo impurity, which is submitted to a fluctuating magnetic field. So that's a well-defined impurity problem in which, on top of the usual Kondo thing, you have a bosonic bath. Okay? And this problem has been hammered with all sorts of techniques. And okay, so basically, if the bath in the SU2 symmetric case, if the bath, the bosonic bath is too strong, you have some local version of the spin liquid, which is very similar to such a PA kind of things. If JK is too big, you have a Kondo problem. That's a critical point.
But if you feed this. The okay. solution of this well-defined problem back into the original.
Then the mess begins.
So, I mean, is it going to get a transition to an anti-ferromagnetic?
No, I mean, so the point is that the self-consistent problem, once you go to the right-hand side, basically the anti-ferromagnetic state in a lattice problem, anti-ferromagnetic state, the true ground state, which you can do by in this approach. There's no static component of the moment, which is part of a self-consistent procedure. But that's a bit of perhaps details.
No, but the transition would still be in your approximation described by this fixed point, the red fixed point. But the
red state will not be described. The physics of destroying the Kondo screening is still controlled by this red fixed point.
But the ordered state will not be described with the green fixed point.
That's right.
So some operator that's irrelevant to the red fixed point is becoming relevant to the green fixed point.
You can think that way. Yeah. I know that's the way you want to think about it. Yeah.
It's dangerously. Right?
Yes. All right. So. Let me just briefly describe. In icing case, actually, one can supplement all this epsilon expansion and all that by actual numerical calculation, which we've done. You find that indeed the transition, that is where is second order. So this is a plot of the order parameter as a function of this control parameter, which is RKKY divided by the bare Kondo scale. So the order parameter goes to 0 is where this E star goes to 0. So these two phenomena of destruction of the Kondo screening and the magnetic transition are happening at the same point. And again, this is incorporating a 2D magnetism in the self-consistent procedure. And you can also look at the male temperature as a function of a control parameter versus the, and it vanishes at the same point where the Kondo screen goes to 0. Yes.
I mean, just going back to this previous discussion, if this ordering is induced by a dangerously irrelevant operator, you'd expect it two scales again. The nail temperature, why wouldn't you expect that's at a different scale from that other guy?
Which guy?
From E local star.
You mean whether the two have the same exponent or not?
Yeah, within your model.
They may very well have, in the SU2 case, they may very well have different exponent. For the SU2 case, that exponent actually has not been worked out. This is the icing case. And this is just showing that indeed the local susceptibility is divergent, and you can also extract the exponent which came out to be looking at the temperature dependence here, or the frequency dependence. It gives you the fractional exponent. Now,
these numbers 0.72 come from imposing some cutoff in some place?
Well, you start from a lattice model with a combination of parameters. So you reach a critical point, determine this exponent. You can start from different set of, say, different Kondo scale, and tune the RKKY coupling to reach another quantum critical point and calculate alpha again. And we've done some, forgot, four or five set of parameters. Alpha came out to be roughly the same within the numerical accuracy. Now, one of the things that follows is that the destruction of a condo screening would lead to a sharp reconstruction of the Fermi surface, because on a parallel magnetic side below this E star scale, one has this condo resonance, unusual heavy fermion physics, and you have a Fermi surface which is large in the sense that the volume would be proportional to 1 plus x, where 1 measures local moment, number per unit cell, x measures the number of conduction electrons per unit cell. Well, if I get into the anti-ferromagnetic metal case, if I look at in the ferromagnetic zone, or if the Fermi surface for conduction electrons are just small, even in the magnetic zone, the Fermi surface would be proportional to x. And one of the issues is that, well, in terms of volume, this phase versus the anti-ferromagnetic metal phase, but with the continuation of the ferromagnetic Fermi surface with some folding, etc., in the magnetic zone would actually be the same, but the shapes are different, the topologies are different. So that, in that sense, it does represent a different phase. And that change of the Fermi surface would presumably lead to a jump of the Hall coefficient, as indeed is seen in ytterbium rhodium to silicon too.
Okay, so yeah. I'm also not understanding here. Is this is a hope, or is this what comes out of the calculation?
Well,
because I mean, this seems awfully discontinuous.
Right. So the two questions. One is let me ask, how could this be second order fission, and then it's a hope versus reality? I mean, the Fermi surface itself is not an order parameter. In some sense, the counting the volume itself is you're just counting where the low-lying excitations are located in the Brillouin zone. What is determining, so the magnetic order parameter can be continuously onsetting without affecting.
But probably magnetic order, magnetic order makes patterns different from this Fermi surface evolutions.
I'm sorry?
Is that local, if that the Fermi surface evolution happens different from quantum critical point?
Yeah. So if the E star local so if you compare this picture versus the nail temperature being here, and the E star local, let's say, is finite, right? Then you have on this side it's the same. You have a large Fermi surface. Now what happens in this phase is that you still can trace this large Fermi surface, but then you fold here and fold everywhere else, okay? And so depending on how you look at it, you can even shift this part here, so then it looks like whole pockets, okay? And if you count the volume of the pockets, it's the same as the volume of the conduction electrons, because now it's a modulo 1 as opposed to modulo 2. But certainly, the shape is very different, for one thing. And the topology is very different. And second is that here, if I adiabatic equal to gap equal to 0 limit, I end up with the same Fermi surface like this. There, I cannot do that. So that's the distinction. So I don't think, in principle, there's any reason for against second order phase transition is possible. And
can I
stand
up for a minute and
sure.
tell you what the problem with that is?
Yeah.
So suppose I look at an electron here.
Yeah.
Okay. So on this side of the phase transition, that electron has energy 0. And here it's a mile outside the Fermi surface,
yeah.
So it's got energy 6.
Okay.
So how can that happen continuously? If I calculate the energy.
So what happens is that the quasi-particle residue, the weight becomes smaller and smaller, and it goes to 0 when you approach it from left for the quasi-particle wave from left. So it's like it's like a ghost which.
So progressively, your Fermi surface from the left becomes more square-like.
It doesn't change shape.
As you go towards the quantum,
suppose I approach from here.
You march from there. Yeah.
Yeah. The Fermi
surface.
Yeah, but it's just that the quasi-particle residue would be becoming smaller and smaller, and it goes to zero at a critical point.
Does the quasi-particle residue come into Fermilinians?
No. So, what is your worry? You worry that energy is jumping.
I calculate the energy by summing over quasi-particles.
No, but this is an interacting system. How can you?
Well, but I thought you said that, I mean, if it's a Fermi liquid, I can...
Yeah, but the quasi-particle residue is becoming smaller and smaller.
Besides the statement, maybe if you did it, DeHaas asked an experiment to determine the Fermi surface on the left-hand side and the right-hand side. What Fermi surface would that see? So he wants to say that on the left-hand side you'd see this guy, on the right-hand side you'd see this other guy.
I understand.
But thermodynamics is, you know...
But when we're talking about whether it's a first or second order,
no. Yeah, but are you worrying about the ground state? Are you worrying about the ground state energy having a jump or what?
Yeah, or the.
No, but how can that be? Even in first order phase transition, ground
right,
state energy.
Right, that's what I'm saying. It looks to me like I need a first order phase.
No, even in first order, you want more than first order phase.
I mean, it's a clarifying comment on that. In this context, where on one side I'm ignoring, in my view, this question is still largely open. Okay. But let's take a different context in which we would start from a spin liquid, let's say a good, rigid, gapped spin liquid, okay? And then we branch on a condo coupling to some conduction electrons, right? So that's a problem that Sentil and Sajdev have recently looked at, and I also looked at
right. In
some slave boson in field context.
Right.
Okay. So in that case, as you crank up the condo coupling,
yeah. When
the condo coupling is small, there's
yeah. No
question that it doesn't do anything.
Right.
So you have a small Fermi surface.
Right.
As you crank up the conductor, then you have to enter a phase in which finally you can form the large Fermi surface.
Right.
And that transition can no doubt be second order.
No, I don't have any trouble with that. Okay. Here I thought that both sides of this were Fermi liquids. So I thought I know how to do calculation.
But maybe I can.
In yours, one of side is completely non-Fermi liquid.
Right. And your seemingly paradoxical remark is solved by at least in the very simplest mean field by the fact that the quasi-particle residue is just vanishing at that point.
No, it's zero.
It goes to zero from left.
Zero on one side and non-zero on the other side.
The point is, if I'm calculating the susceptibility in a Fermi liquid or something, I sum over the Fermi surface, Z doesn't come into that calculator. I mean, Z equals zero is one thing, but Z equals 10 to the minus 6 is entirely different.
No, so we agree on that, at least.
Yeah,
right?
I agree
okay.
with you.
Right. No, I don't have any more to say.
With the puzzle we began with, it. Something like that, as T goes to zero, will jump discontinuously, and that's how he wants to explain the jump and the all number.
Right.
Something like that. The T goes to zero limit of something will indeed jump, and that's why it will look first order. But anything that integrates over finite energies
sure.
will now integrate over something bigger, and will, like thermodynamic quantity, be contained.
Right. The zero temperature is a ground state energy.
That's not one of the most confirmed structures.
Well, ground state energy. No, it would apply, I don't know, Zeeman, infinitesimal Zeeman field to calculate
the
susceptibility.
But the scale that would operate in the temperature that the formula that would be true will all shrink as you go to the quantum critical point. Presumably that's what. And so that all of that will conspire to give you jumps in Fermi liquid parameters that you go across while linking it with the. You'd actually have two Cheshire cats vanishing at the same point.
Well, at the quantum critical, it's a very interesting question. It's a very interesting question. What happens exactly at a quantum critical point? You know, whether the Fermi excitations happen. Yeah. So there was a question of whether this was true or this was hope. So we think this microscopic approach. I mean that. That has to follow once the condo screening has disappeared, because
But do you calculate the whole?
No, we haven't calculated. No, I mean that's yeah. I wish I could calculate that.
But
I mean, even in principle, can you calculate such things within your local approximation, or are they even well-defined approaches?
Well, it has been calculated within this class of approaches, yes. Resistivity has been calculated, or coefficient has been calculated. That's right, yeah. These are correlation functions one can still analyze. So I'm just mentioning, I mean, local nature. In some sense, the Fermi surface evolution is very essential for this way of thinking of the critical point, that one does have a sharp reconstruction of the Fermi surface across the quantum critical point. And within this approach, this localization of F electrons actually also leads to effective mass, which is divergent. And that's related to the Z, which is going to zero at the critical point. And so one has this anomalous spin dynamics, the fractional exponent, etc., and the destruction of the Kondo effect. So the critical theory certainly is not just the fluctuations of the magnetic order parameter. So I think, you know, this microscopic approach at least provides a handle. We know it recovers the Kondo phase, which is actually not trivial. There's not too many approaches which can give you the Kondo large Fermi surface phase, but certainly it's still an approximation. And starting from a caricature like this, one can ask a behaviors, question of stability of a phase like this with a nil order, but a small Fermi surface in a sense of conduction electrons only in part of electron spectrum. Whether that's stable and et cetera, and how much time should I? A few minutes and quit. So, yeah. Okay. So one of the interesting questions which actually came up during this my stay here was that actually to think, can we think about, for instance, stability of such a nil order state with small Fermi surface in a more general sense. Now, if we are in an Einstein case, presumably the spectrum is gapped, the Kondo screening to infinitesimal Kondo screening to fermions would not do anything, so this phase would be stable. In the Heisenberg case, the situation is more subtle because we have magnons near Q and gapless excitations near Q equal to zero. And for the magnetic, for the magnons near pi pi, if the Fermi surface of the fermions is small enough, presumably this coupling is irrelevant due to this incommensuration effect. However, the coupling of the fermions to the magnetic excitations near Q equal to zero, well, it's there. It's certainly phase space allows that. And in some sense, for higher dimensions, this represents a problem which in principle can be exactly solved. There's only forward scattering and all that. And I think this problem has not really been worked out just yet, but it actually reminded me of a problem which we've looked at with different motivation in mind. This was the 1D Kondo lattice where you couple the 1D spin chain to 1D fermions. And that problem, there's historically, there's a number of authors listed here who have, and others who have looked at this problem. But what we find is that whether you introduce spin anisotropy or not has important consequences. So for instance, if you're in strictly, so there, if it's for different reasons, there's no, of course, the spin chain is in a left integer, is not magnetic ordered. But again, the pi-pi modes cannot couple to the fermions because of incommensuration. And that leaves only the uniform mode to be coupled, to be able to couple to the fermions, and is why the transverse and longitudinal coupling of that that type of Kondo coupling, which was written in the previous transparency, And so k tau equals 1 is where you have SU2 symmetry. And there, the Kondo couplings are all marginal and marginally relevant. But if you introduce XY anisotropy, k tau becomes larger than 1, and the transverse Kondo coupling actually becomes irrelevant. So whether there's something like this that happens in this higher dimensional problem inside the magnetic order state, I think it's an interesting problem to actually work out. So with
so how does this issue of small Fermi surface versus big Fermi surface play out?
Well, when the white curve is irrelevant, you have a small Fermi surface of conduction electrons, Fermi points, which are decoupled from the spin chain. When it's relevant, the 1D physics kicks in. There's a spin gap and all these things, which you can see historically by various methods. We recently even did some large N generalization of a model where you can see explicitly the spin gap. And I think Alexei Tsvalik has some unpublished result of the calculations of the correlation functions in that phase. And again, you see the spectrum.
Is that the nature of the quantum paramagnet you were talking about before in the higher dimensional phase?
It's no, I think it's very different. I mean, certainly spin gap makes a very different. But so then you can't define really a Fermi surface.
Right.
But it looks at first sight looks
like
that.
Non-analyticity occurs in the.
It's like a paired state.
It's like a paired state. There's still some notion of 2 kF. No notion of 1 kF, but there's still a notion of 2 kF.
In fact, there's, I think, a 2 kF star mode, which is gapless in charged sector, where kF star
is
1 plus.
Yeah,
that's right, yeah.
The question of continuity doesn't arise because it's in the space.
The case.
The question of continuity from small to big.
Yeah, I mean, there's a gap on the one side.
It doesn't arise because it's sort of a regime. Maybe the speed gap is interesting.
Yeah, so I mean,
if
yeah, so I mean, single electron excitation spectrum is gapped, but if you take if you look at charge density modes, there's this 2 kF star.
Always.
And but no,
yeah.
Only
no, you yeah. Always have that. The question is whether you also have 1 and 2 kF.
That's correct. Right. Yeah. So on the side where the PEP transverse coupling is irrelevant, you also have 2 kF mode.
Exactly.
That's right. Yeah. So I think I'm actually done. Yeah. So just leave the conclusions here. Thank you.
This issue of local quantum criticality, does it arise from the 1D?
It does not. So, I mean, the only thing that.
You can do the calculation with.
That's right. The only thing that comes close actually is this this flow G equation I've written down. And. So if this is a k tau, and this is a transverse coupling of the q equals 0 component of the Kondo coupling, let me assume that this this next nearest neighbor coupling of spin chain is such that the backscattering term of spin is equal to 0, just to simplify the discussion, and the phase boundaries looks something like this, where here. You have kF for sure, okay? A gapless electron excitation at kF and kF only. And there it's a spin gap, okay? And there's this 2 kF star mode of the charge which remains there. And you can ask what's the behavior at this at the transition. Well, the transition is caused by the thallus. So the 1D thing basically makes the critical behavior to be essentially the same. As the behavior inside the phase, except for
there is momentum dependence. You don't see local quantum
criticality. Well, let's see. Momentum dependence of what? Yeah, so let's see. It's interesting. If you look at the local sensitivity, it's still divergent along at the transition point. Now, it's interesting to ask what the chi q omega is doing. Yeah, that actually has not been looked at. I think we should know the answer because we know the, how to calculate it inside the phase, so therefore we also know how to calculate it at the critical point. Yeah.
Can I ask one more quick question? So simpler to count back to the higher dimensional case.
Yeah, sure.
Suppose I calculate the Pauli susceptibility.
Mm-hmm.
So will that's presumably easier than actually calculating the Hall conductance. Is that going to have a discontinuity across your transition?
You want to calculate Q equals zero.
Q equals zero.
Omega equals zero.
Omega equals
and
zero.
And then T equals zero susceptibility.
I want to calculate the second derivative of the ground state energy with respect to a Zeeman field.
Well, let's see. So
that's rho of EF.
Yeah.
Rho is some particularly weighted.
Yeah. I would, I mean, there could be a minor. So I know that, of course, the finite Q susceptibility is having non-analyticity by the anti-fellow magnetic susceptibility. It should have, yeah, it's an interesting question whether
so
it's a
magnetic
yeah.
order presumably makes essentially no contribution.
Yeah. So if
it's going to measure.
Yeah. Since my mass is diverging from left, the susceptibility, yeah, there should be some jump probably. The uniform spin susceptibility. I have the mass goes to infinity physics from left because of z goes to zero, and I don't have the mass at the mean field level certainly. I don't have the mass goes to infinity physics if I approach from the other side. So I would expect this susceptibility.
Yeah, the jump. Lots of things should jump. The residual system between the and so on.
Yeah.
Okay. We should certainly thank the speaker again, but since this is our last talk, I need to take the opportunity to encourage us all to thank Leon.